Now, Oxfordshire's Amanda Fielding has dedicated her whole life working in one particular field. She's Countess of Wemyss and is a drug policy reformer who spent the last 50 years tirelessly campaigning to both amend drug policies and initiate scientific research into psychoactive substances. And she's here right now. It's lovely to have you here. Born and bred Oxfordshire, actually.
Yes, I was born on the edge of Otmoor and lived there all my life.
You've never left.
Yeah.
Although you've lived in London, haven't you?
I've lived in London for a long time, but it was always my home. I mean, my parents lived there, always came back there. Mm. I had a little cabin there where I always retired to, and I still live there now, so I love it.
But your work takes you all over the world, Amanda.
Yes, yes. I work from the cow shed at Beckley, and it has spread around the world, yes.
I love the fact that actually the Beckley Foundation is based in a cow shed, but it's having influence worldwide. Everything that takes place happens, the conversations that happen in the cow shed are influential the world over.
Yes.
It's brilliant. Right, well, it's lovely to have you here. Thank you so much. Of all the campaigning, the 50 years of tireless campaigning that you've done, Amanda, to amend drug policies, so far, what's been your greatest achievement? What's been the most important of all? Of course, all important, but perhaps what stands out?
Well, I mean, my passion wasn't really to amend drug policy. That was just a necessity because I saw it come in and it was quite obvious it was going to be a total devastating disaster to the world.
Of prohibition.
The war on drugs and prohibition. But my passion was really to understand better about consciousness and its changing states. That had been my passion from a very small child, because Beckley, where I live, is completely isolated. There was no one, no children, no one to play with, no toys, nothing except a very beautiful place, and to mooch around thinking about oneself and the world and people. And so consciousness became my passion, and I studied finally about changing states of consciousness with the great Professor Zainer at All Souls. So it was always my passion. And psychoactive compounds are one way of changing consciousness. So it became a very early interest of mine. And what I wanted to do was the scientific study to understand, so we better understand what are the underlying mechanisms in changing states of consciousness and how can they help mankind.
I find it astonishing and incredible that you sort of had this grip on consciousness and the changing states of consciousness. Probably you didn't communicate it in that way when you were a child.
No.
But you had nothing to play with particularly, no toys, and then you found your own way to spend your time as a child. I find it fascinating. It's had such an effect.
I suppose I had an influence in my father. His best friend was someone called Bertie Moore, who became a very distinguished and famous Buddhist monk. And he was my godfather. And so I never met him, but he was a very strong influence. So from a very early age, I got very interested in Buddhism. Hmm. And funny enough, when I...
When you say from an early age?
8, 10, that sort of age.
You were a mature child.
I was mature because I grew up with grown-ups. And so the conversation was grown-ups' conversation, not children's conversation, because it was very isolated, Beckley. Where we live is down a very bumpy track, which used to have 7 gates, and we live at the end of that track in a house which has 3 medieval moats around it. Mm. So it has a very isolated feel. And my parents had actually no cash, so we had no petrol or heating. So we lived in this isolated island on the edge of the Fen, which is Otmoor.
But what your parents had was a thoroughly modern approach to parenting, because back in perhaps the day that you were growing up, children were seen and not heard, but you at 8 were making your very own mature decisions.
I think that was my father's influence, yes. He was an outsider and a rebel and a person who believed in following what you think in your brain, not going by the experts or what the government says, or doing your own thing. Mm. He was one of those.
So the path that led you into founding the Beckley Foundation in 1996?
Yes.
What was that path?
That path was, from this passion for the study of consciousness and mysticism, that experience, which is the kind of centre of every religion. Funny enough, I at 16, I won the school. I think it was an international science prize. And I wanted books on Buddhism, and the nuns didn't give it to me. They said, no, Amanda, we'll give you art books. So I thought, well, enough of this. I'll leave school, thank you very much, and go and educate myself. So then I went travelling with actually no money, and I was heading off to Sri Lanka, where Bertie, my godfather, lived on an island as a Buddhist monk. Anyway, I never got there, but had incredible adventures on the way, living in the desert and living with the Bedou and all sorts of adventures. Mm. And then I came back, and for some way I managed to start studying with Professor Zainer at All Souls, who was the kind of world's expert on religions, and had just written a book called Mysticism, Sacred and Profane. And so I went and had tutorials with him once a week, and also studied classical Arabic to read the Sufis, and did sculpture. Anyway, I did that. And that led me to this interest in different religions and mystical experiences and that area.
So then, but it's not often that religion and drugs collide.
Well, the funny thing is, now I'm doing... It's very interesting how the meditative, religious, mystical experience is very similar to the brain states that you get through use of a psychedelic. It changes the brain in the similar way. I mean, obviously, it's not identical, but now that finally, after all these years, because Prohibition, when it came in the late 60s, although it wasn't meant to, as probably you know, it was instigated by the US, and it was written up by the United Nations, and 165 countries signed into it. So it was global. Mm. And it hasn't been changed, not one word of it, in the last 50 years, although it was based on inaccuracies. There was no scientific base, and it prohibited the use of all psychoactive substances. And you just can't do that. It won't work. People want to change their consciousness.
But if we can do that with meditation, isn't that a far better way of actually changing our consciousness if
it has
the same kind
way.
Of effect?
Absolutely. It's an absolutely wonderful way, but it's a very slow track way. You know, you don't... it takes a long time and a lot of concentration to become a really good meditator. And by using... My interest was really in the field of... The trouble with the word drugs, it covers an enormous... Mm. It's like vegetables or whatever. You know, they're very different. And cannabis and the psychedelics are a totally different type of drug to opiates and cocaine and amphetamine and all the other drugs. But because they're all called drugs, they all fall under the same international rules, more or less, which is prohibition. Mm. And so I discovered when I was 16, in 1960, I was first introduced to cannabis and thought, well, this is amazing. I happened, as most other people were, to be listening to Ray Charles, as one does, you know, and one heard it at many, many different levels and much deeper and much more wonderful. And I thought, this is amazing. So then that was interesting. And then later, whenever it was 1965, I was introduced to LSD, and that was very much got one to that mystical state of consciousness, which I had been studying about with Professor Zainer and studying it ever since I was, 14 or something. Mm. And I realized suddenly, I'm experiencing that experience, not reading about it. It's amazing. But that wasn't the big change in my life. The big change came the next year when I met a Dutch scientist, doctor of exceptional, I think, genius, called Bart Hoogeth, who had hypotheses about what was the changes in physiology underlying these changes in consciousness. And from that moment, I started getting a passion to really do scientific research into how these compounds work and how we can use them to help humanity overcome a lot of our big problems.
Of course, I mean, there's such a murky side to the whole the drug conversation, isn't there? But actually, yes. I mean, in the case of, for example, Billy Caldwell,
yes,
the young autistic man with a boy, yes, with epilepsy,
yeah.
And
yeah,
his mother fought tirelessly, of course, yes, for him to be allowed,
yes,
to take a psychoactive substance, cannabis, yes, oil, in,
yes,
fact.
Yes.
And, of course, that was granted.
Well, finally.
But there's a lot of ignorance
finally,
around. There's
still
a lot of people thinking, well, why is this young teenage boy allowed to take a mind-altering substance?
Yes. Now, the point is, there's been 50 years of education. I don't blame the poor public for being terrified of these compounds.
But do you think as well it's the public not knowing the full facts, because the full,
yes,
facts are not given to the public?
Absolutely. They've had a media barrage of misinformation. I mean, of course drugs can be devastatingly dangerous, but the dangers are exaggerated by a criminal market. If from the beginning we had started with a regulated market, very, very carefully thought up by the experts in charge, and instead of criminalising, we made it a health issue.
Mm.
We were protecting the health of the population. And that would have been a much better way to go.
I mean, we're talking about very controlled microdoses, aren't we, of psychedelics?
With psychedelics, they're a completely different category, and each category of drugs has to be dealt with individually. And psychedelics, and indeed cannabis, have been used by humanity from the beginning of our culture. At least psychedelics have. We can see in the cave paintings of 44,000 years ago the influence and the pictorial of psychoactive mushrooms, for instance. And so it's been intertwined with human society right from the beginning as something sacred, at the kind of centre of the sacred part of society. And I think also it kind of helped us evolve language and culture and music and art.
Well,
and
absolutely, music.
Yes.
I mean, that was a sort of a big thing that it had a huge influence on.
Absolutely. And then it was slightly esoteric. In the classical world, people don't know this, but all the great philosophers, Plato, Socrates, all the people, went to somewhere called Eleusis, where they partook of a sacred drink, which was a psychedelic drink, and they underwent a psychedelic experience.
Mm.
And that was the centre of the classical world. Mm.
You're not suggesting that we all, you know, try and get hold of some psychedelics and,
no,
you know,
not at all.
And suddenly become incredibly creative, because that's absolutely not, you know, I'm never going to write a song that was as good as the Beatles,
but,
Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds or something like that.
Absolutely. But on the other hand, I think we don't want to suppress the minority people who are drawn or to experiment with altered states of consciousness. It shouldn't be a crime. They should be.
But shouldn't we not be much more sort of having a conversation, concentrating on actually people that need a psychedelic because they have a health problem, they might
well,
have a mental health problem, rather than just because they want to write a good song?
I totally agree. And that's what I do in the Beckley Foundation, is I had to do the policy to enable myself to be able to do the science. And so for the last 20 years, I've been doing really cutting-edge, breaking-through science, looking at how the psychedelics work, with the latest brain imaging technology. How do they have their effect? So how do we know what their dangers are more clearly, and also what their possible benefits
are? Do they have a long-term effect on the brain? Do they alter the brain long-term?
Positively, yes. There's an afterglow. So now, in the last 15 years, we've been using very, very small studies around the world. I've been involved in, initiated some, and others joined, to use psychedelics, and we use particularly the magic mushroom, psilocybin, because, one, no one can spell it, no one knows what the word is, so it doesn't have a taboo, whereas LSD has a terrible taboo, and therefore is much more difficult to work with. So we've done work with psilocybin. I've worked with Johns Hopkins in the USA, a very leading university, And there we did a study using psilocybin-aided psychotherapy to overcome addiction. And we used nicotine, which is a very difficult addiction to overcome, and actually had an amazing, the first pilot study, which was not many people, and but we had an 80% success rate. And
What's stopping this then? What's getting in the way? Because what you're doing is evidence-based over a long, long period of time.
Yes.
It's evidence-based scientific research. So why are our drugs in this way not used more widely?
Absolutely. Well, if I might say, I think we're at a turning point.
So change is imminent?
Yes. I think we've reached a tipping point. And, you know, there's much more interest in that these compounds could be a new paradigm for psychiatry. Because psychiatry, we're in an epidemic of mental illness at the moment. And America is in an epidemic of opioid addiction. I mean, it's something like 40,000 people a year are dying from opioid use in America. I mean, it's terrifying. And that's because we went the wrong way at that point. Instead of learning how to use the best scientific and political brains to think, how do we best regulate these substances to diminish harms and protect the youth, we criminalized, and that created the criminal market. But back to the tipping point, now there's been a build-up of evidence, like another study I set up with Professor David Nutt, my co-partner. We set up the Beckley Imperial Psychedelic Research Program, and one of the studies we did was using psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy to overcome treatment-resistant depression. And again, we had very, very effective results. Kind of 63 of these people, 63% were depression-free after the taking.
Amanda, ultimately, what do you want to be one day remembered for? When we think of Amanda Fielding and all the tireless work that you've done within this field, what would you like to be remembered for?
I think probably reintegrating into society the careful, positive realization that altering states of consciousness can be amazing tools to heal and improve well-being and creativity. It's a multi-positive potential if we approach it clearly, scientifically, responsibility. Mm-hmm. There's immense potential in these compounds to improve human health, happiness, compassion. They're incredible compounds. And what one has to remember with psychedelics is the idea is LSD, gosh, it knocks you out and can drive you mad. Actually, it can be a little pussycat, a field mouse. You can take it in tiny quantities, which just act to give a little bit more stimulation, which could be wonderful for the elderly, because it increases the cerebral circulation of the brain. And, you know, these things we haven't yet explored.
Amanda, it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for coming in and being my guest this morning.
Thank you,
Amanda Fielding.